Greetings to all of God's people. This is again Mordecai Joseph. We're today in lesson 180, and we finished last time the story that is a series, mini-series of Esau and Jacob, the twin brothers, and their mortal struggle. In other words, mortal enemies, unfortunately, instead of being brothers. And the implications throughout history and prophecy and into this day and into the future. And so now we're back to the story of Jacob. At this point, God is going to concentrate mainly on the sons of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Israel, and then obviously those who came in contact with them. But the story now will concentrate from this point on, basically until the end of the book and beyond that, with the children of Israel, and not Esau or Ishmael, though they are mentioned later on. But now Jacob, as commanded by his father and mother, being blessed, he's going on his way to his family back east, to Babylon in essence, and that part was called Aram, and the people of Abraham, that is Sarah, his father, he left Babylon, Ur of the Chaldean, that is way down there, but the Babylon Empire controlled the whole territory, so it still was a part of the territory of Babylon, and then later on became a part of Syria, northern Syria, and then obviously when Assyria became an empire, they took over that place, and that was the nature of things those days. And so he's on his way to Haran, and Haran was a city, a brother of Abraham that died in Ur of the Chaldean before his family migrated in this direction, supposing that they would reach the final destination, which is the land of Canaan, and that's not what God had in mind. And so they remained in that city and multiplied there, and that became the city of that family. So everybody that basically was in that city was the family of Abraham, and obviously all their servants. And so this is what Jacob is going to find, in other words, to take a wife. And really the main reason for it, he needed to flee from the wrath of his brother Esau, and at the same time also have a wife, take a wife, that is, from there, sort of killing two birds in one stone. And so we are back now in chapter 28, in verse 1 we read, and Jacob went out from Beersheba, that's where his father was, that's in the south, and went toward Haran, and that's quite a long distance, which means that instead of going, if you look at the map, instead of going directly east, he had to go up north, and through the upper Galilee, present-day Galilee, into the land of Syria, and then way up there. And so Jacob went out from Beersheba, that's quite a distance, and he went toward Haran, and he lighted upon a place and tarried there all night. That's the first day, because the sun was set. In Hebrew, Bah HaShemesh. That was terminology that God later on used in describing the time of the Passover, as he told his people Israel, that I believe it is in the book of Deuteronomy, where he says that you keep the Passover at the time when the sun comes, uses the same terminology. In other words, toward sunset. Wasn't dark yet, in other words, not really sunset where it's dark, but as you get closer toward that time when the sun goes down, that's what the terminology here is. No terminology of sunset in Hebrew here, later on it came, which means shkiah, setting down. And now they just use the ancient terminology when the sun comes. In other words, it goes up, and then when it comes down. And so at that point, he obviously is going to rest for the night. And so in English, they use the word sunset, because the sun was set. And he took one of the stones of the place and put it under his head and lay down that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. Obviously, it's just a dream. There is no ladder that goes up high. And behold, the angels of Elohim, or God, descending, that is ascending and descending on it. So the angels go up and down. And verse 13, we read where God is. And behold, the Lord, or Jehovah, stood beside him and said, I am Jehovah, the God of Abraham, your father. As we covered this subject before that, in the days of Moses, when God told Moses that by my name Jehovah was not known unto the fathers, and people who read it without background and context, they don't understand what it really means, and they think that Moses was the first one to know the name of Jehovah, the personal name. That's not what God was saying. And unfortunately, it's a pitfall for many who read the Bible. It's not enough to read it. You have to understand it, and understanding doesn't necessarily come from human intelligence. Many things can be understood if true, if we study and research and put things together. But other elements of the Bible have to be understood and can be understood only by revelation. You know, the Spirit of God leads us to understand it. And this is what confuses many people, you know, sincere people. And at times we are those people, you know, we sincerely read something, we believe that's what it means, and we get something totally out of it that is different from what it really is. And that's the reason why we have so many diversities and differences and arguments and different doctrines and splits and all kind of things like that. In areas when we don't all see eye to eye, obviously, we need the Holy Spirit there and should not rely on human intelligence. Anyway, in this case, the God that dealt with the fathers was the one that was also known as Jehovah, and also the Father also is known by the name Jehovah, because all it means is was, is, and will be, eternal. And this eternal later on, as we shall read, came back to Jacob about 20 years later, while he was with Laban and wishing to depart, and told him, and the description there is that he appears as the angel of the Lord. That's the way Jacob describes him. And so the angel of the Lord comes there and he says to him and to Jacob in another dream that he is the God of Bethel. He's the Elohim of Bethel. And of course, that's quite a head scratcher for the rabbis as they read it, and those who don't understand it, you know, how can he be an angel and be God? And so some of them say, well, I guess God is called sometimes angel. And angel is a messenger. So if he's a messenger, whose messenger is he? You see, but we know what, don't believe that there are two divine beings, that you're stuck. And that seems to be a problem also of brethren who used to know better, who were members of the body of Christ, and had a better understanding that there are two divine beings. Both of them are Elohim, both of them are Jehovah. So now they lost that understanding of the thing, no, God is only one, and Jesus Christ, he could be an angel, it could be this, could be that, but certainly he's not God. Instead of understanding, God is not a biblical word anyway, and should not even be used in theological terms in order to understand, because God is in singular, Elohim is in the plural. You see, so it's God really means a deity, you see, but Elohim is not a deity, but several ones, more than two, though it is applied sometimes only to one. But it's applicable to more than one, and therefore there is no contradiction here, and there is no confusion here, and, you know, they shouldn't be confused about monotheism in the ultimate sense. And so anyway, here he says, I am the eternal, I'm the Jehovah, the Elohim of Abraham. You see, Jehovah is in the singular, Jehovah, and Elohim is in the plural. And I am the Elohim of Abraham, your father, and the Elohim of Isaac. The land whereon you lie, to you will I give it, and to your seed. And some in their ignorance, and there are people who should know better, they're children of Israel, but lost their understanding, and they read this, and they say, well, I guess the only inheritance he gave him is just that 2x6 square foot that he was lying on. Well, you know, that's sometimes how people are very interestingly, you might say, funny in the way they understand the Bible. In other words, people will say, well, I take the Bible literally. No, you cannot take it literally. On the other hand, you know, you can take it literally when it's supposed to be literally. In this case, it doesn't mean literally. only the little piece of land that he was sleeping on. And so you have to know, as you study the Bible, when to take things literally, when to understand that what it says is not what it means. And that's the reason it says that the wise shall understand, and the wisdom begins only when people fear God, and when people fear God, they obey God, and they lean to His understanding and wait on His Spirit to explain things they cannot understand. You see? And that's the way it goes. And so he says, the land whereon you lie, to you will I give it and to your seed. Obviously, that should all, you know, make it very plain. You know, if it is to you and to your seed, you know, well, they need more than that tiny little piece of land. And your seed shall be as the dust of the earth, and you certainly need much more piece of land. And you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. Well, that whole statement makes it very plain that this notion that somebody came up with, that the only land that he gave him is only a tiny little piece of land that he was sleeping on. Explanation here makes it very plain. It's everywhere that Jacob went, literally. He's not talking only about that point when he's going to inherit the land of Canaan later on, that is, after Egypt, but he's saying very plainly here something that is applicable to the many generations to come until this very day. Wherever Jacob went, you see, God gave him that land, north and south and east and west. And he did not limit that blessing only to the land of Canaan, but literally everywhere Jacob, the footsteps of Jacob come, God gives him that land, because God is the God of the whole earth. Of course, lots of people don't like this idea, but this is the God of Israel, and he does what he wants to. And so this is what he says here. And you're going to go north and east and west and south, and in you and in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And this has double meaning. And when I said double meaning, I mean it all in the sense that not only in Jacob and the Savior that came out of Jacob, which is one meaning, that is going to be a blessing for all the earth, but also wherever Jacob went, east, west, south, and north, and you know, and everywhere, and west, wherever Jacob is, because God is with him, at least to the degree that he obeys God, obviously, but even then, sometimes God blessed Jacob, or oftentimes blessed Jacob, even when Jacob did not know God as he should. But still, in blessing Jacob, wherever he went, east, north, you know, and west, and south, and everywhere, other peoples who were not of Jacob were also being blessed by the physical qualities of Jacob, the blessings that God gave Jacob, and also the spiritual knowledge that Jacob has, even though it may be limited as such. And so that blessing was carried through Jacob into all the earth, all the land, that is, the whole planet, not only in the sense that of Jacob being in the land and therefore a light to the world, and the Savior coming out of Jacob and being the light of the world and the Savior of mankind, but also literally wherever Jacob went, and you're going to, you know, you can see it, and this is a fact that nobody can disprove. Everywhere where Jacob is, any son of Jacob is, you know, there is a blessing there, not only for Jacob, but also for the people around them. So if they went to the Caucasian Mountains, there was a blessing there. And if they went to Europe, there is a blessing there. And if they went to the Americas, there is a blessing there for them and for those who dwell with them. The families and the nations and the cities and the peoples of Jacob and their territories are always blessed to one degree or the other. And those strangers who are with them are also being blessed. So this is what he's talking about. You have to, you know, study the totality of the statement that he's making here. And some people are narrow-minded and don't understand the full scope of it. And so this is what he's saying here. And in your seed and in your, that is, in you and in your seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go. And he's not talking only about temporarily now, as he's going to the land of Haran, You see, and he's not talking about only when God will bring Israel into the land of Canaan, but literally wherever Jacob went, any son of Jacob, any daughter of Jacob in the next many generations, to the coming of Jesus Christ and into the future, God is going to be with them. And so God does not dwell only in the land of Israel. You see, though that was the central location of him, of his dwelling, but then he told him later on, as he went to Egypt, I'll go down with you. You see? So wherever God had his people, had his children, he is there also. Though true, in terms of a religious site, Jerusalem was chosen to be the city and no other city. And the land of Israel is called the inheritance of the Lord and the land of the Lord. But it's true also that wherever Jacob went, God was with him, and therefore he blessed also the people around him. And so he says, well, I will be with you, I will keep you wherever you go, and will bring you back into this land. For I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken to you of. And that again has the implication of the totality of the whole history of Jacob. You see, and his descendants, and his peoples, and the nations that came out of him, and the lands into which they went, either by migration or initially by captivity. You see, God said, I will be with you wherever you are, and I will bring you back to this land, and ultimately, this is the end of the story, when God is going to bring back all the children of Israel at his coming, the coming of Jesus Christ, and the second time in the second resurrection. He's going to bring the children of Israel from all over the earth into the land of Israel, and this is in essence what you see here, the totality of the fulfillment of this statement. So it's a far-reaching statement that had to do in terms from the days of Jacob, we're talking about 2,800 years to this day, and into the future another 1,000 years. So this is a promise for 3,800 years history of Jacob. And so Jacob awoke out of his sleep, and he said, truly, Jehovah is in this place. So you see, he knows the name of Jehovah, and that's what he's saying. And he says, surely the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not. So he's saying here, and I knew it not, and he was afraid and said, how full of awe is this place? And he's so amazed by the dream, and he's so awestruck by it, and so he's reacting in this manner, and he was afraid. Well, afraid, that's in the sense of a reverence toward God. That was an awesome thing that he experienced, because Jacob, unlike his father Isaac and his grandfather Abraham, never had personal contact with God. And so this is, in essence, the first time that he has it. And so he was afraid and said, how full of awe is this place? This is none other than the house of Elohim. And later on was called Bet El, short El, or Elohim. And this is none other than the house of Elohim. And this is the gate of heaven. Now, as time went by, people began to understand, as later on Jesus Christ would mention, that wherever people worship God, wherever they are, in whatever land they may be, it doesn't have to be in Jerusalem or any other place, wherever as they address God, it is as if the gate of heaven is exactly in the same place where they stand. And so this is beyond just a particular place for Jacob. That place was the gate of heaven. But then, wherever Jacob went, you know, when he went to Egypt, that too became the gate of heaven. In other words, you have an access to God. That's in essence what it means. And so later on, when Jesus Christ again, speaking about this very thing, when he was talking to the woman, Samaritan woman in John 4, that's what he said to her, you know, woman, you know, the hour will come when you shall neither worship God either in Jerusalem or in this mountain. You see, because God is spirit, God is everywhere. But wherever people are going to be, they're going to worship God in truth and in spirit. And it's not going to be only in one, you know, central location, where if you're not there, you cannot pray to God. You see, when Daniel was in Babylon, he was in the king's palace. He opened the gates, that is, the windows, and he looked toward Jerusalem, true. But he prayed from there, and God heard him there. So that was his gate, the gate of heaven. So it's a concept, in essence. It's not just a locale, but it's a concept. Wherever you are, and that's the reality of it, if you walk with God, the gate of heaven is open to you. Sort of an idiom. The gate of heaven. Having an access to God. And so Jacob rose up early in the morning and took the stone that he had put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil upon the top of it. Now, he wasn't setting the stone as an altar to sacrifice on. After all, just one stone. But he set it apart as a place, so when he comes back to it, he would know exactly the exact location of that rock. After all, if you put oil on rock, it's going to remain there for quite a while, and when he comes back, you'll recognize it. So it had two purposes here. One is to sanctify that rock, and the second one is to remind him when he comes back which one of the rocks is the one. And so he poured oil on top of it, and he called the name of that place Bet El, the house of El, house of, well, in English or former German, Gott or God. But the name of the city was Luz. In Hebrew it's Luz, in English it's Laz. At the first. And Jacob vowed a vow. Now, mind you, this is exactly what he's doing here, because some people have misunderstood this and made it into something else. So I have to read the context, and have the background to it and understand what you're reading. And so Jacob vowed a vow. So this is a vow that we're talking about here. It's not a law, it's a vow. See, there's a difference between a law and a vow. And he vowed a vow saying, if God will be with me, which obviously he knew he will, and to him the question is not if, he knew he will, but he's in essence saying that I'm making a vow here, when God is with me and gives me all these things, this is what I'm going to do. So remember, it is a vow. God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I go, that is toward the city of Haran, and will give me bread to eat and raiment to put on. In other words, if he'll take care of me so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then shall the Lord or Jehovah be my Elohim, my deity, no one else. And this stone which I have set for a pillar shall be God's house. In other words, a place where I will come from time to time to serve God and bring an offering to God and sacrifices to God. And this is what he's saying here. And of all that you shall give me, I will surely give the tenth unto you. You see? Now some people look at it and says, aha, this is the tithing law. It's not talking about a tithing law, and it's not talking about tithing either. He's making a vow. You see? He's making a vow that when I come back to this place, whatever I bring with me, you see, and be it food, grain, whatever it may be, but mainly animals, this is what you carry with you. You don't carry, tons of grain with you, but you can carry an awful lot of, you can bring an awful lot of cattle with you, and sheep and lambs and all that. So that's in essence what he's talking about. And whatever, after all, when you talk about grain, it has to be harvested, and he's not going to be harvesting, traveling, but he's going to have cattle with him. So in essence, this is what he's saying here, that whatever cattle I'm going to have with me, whatever riches, and that's what riches was to people in those days, I'm going to take one-tenth of it, and write on this stone, which later on when he comes back, he's going to erect an altar, obviously, he's going to offer it to God. So we're not talking about the tithe. You see, that's a totally different concept. Now the amount is the same, but he's not talking about the tithe here. You see, he's talking about a vow that he's making. I'm going to take 10% of what I have, and I'm going to offer it on this altar as a sacrifice. You see, a tithe doesn't have that purpose. A tithe, you take later on, which became a law in Sinai, because for the first time there was a nation. You see, up to now there is no nation, just individuals. So it's a totally different concept. And you take this tithe that you offer to God in a vow, and you offer it literally to God. You see, well, a tithe was something else. You took it and you gave it to the priest, and he sustained him, you see. After all, the priest needs to eat too, and the Levites. And so that was a totally different principle, different concept. And, you know, when people don't understand the mix of the two, and they say, aha, you see, you know, tithing has been in the Bible, and here it is. There's an example of it. And Abraham had done the same, you see. Abraham didn't go to work and produce. Abraham went to war, and he came back with the booty. And he took some of the sheep that he had there, and he offered it to Melchizedek. You see, he gave him a tenth of all that he had. You see, of all that he brought with him from the war. And as for the rest, he gave it back to the king of Sodom and you know, all the others. He didn't take anything to himself beside that. So there was not, again, a matter of, you know, you go to work, God, you know, gives you a job or gives you a piece of land and you harvest from it and you take a tenth of it and you give it to God. In other words, you give it to the ministry or the priest to do the work of God, whatever it may be. These two are totally separate concepts, and people that have no perception of knowing the difference, they combine both and they think this is the same thing, and it's not. This is something that you do in a particular case. This is what you do also in terms of the old days when the king came, you know, you brought him an offering, and in some places, you know, the kings would especially when they were absolute kings, they demanded one-tenth of what you had. So I had to give them a tithe. But then it was not, again, the same thing as the tithing law. See, the tithing law is not this. And the two should not be confused. And so when people want to prove tithing, if they go to this one, they obviously show that they do not understand what is really happening here, nor with the father Abraham. They're confusing two things. And that's the reason later on, when the apostles were dealing with the matter of caring for the ministry, they did not use tithing. They never spoke about tithing. They never told the brethren, you've got to give me a tithe. You know, Paul didn't say, you know, you've got to give me a tithe, or else he wouldn't go hungry, because he said many times, I went hungry, and the apostles were hungry. And Christ made it very plain. And you go there, you know, if whatever people said before you, this is what you eat. You don't say, well, you know, I'm here, God's servant, and you owe God 10%, and you owe, you know, and you give it to me, or else you're a thief. You see, those are covetous men that speak like that, unfortunately. And they also confuse people who do not understand what they're reading. And unfortunately, you know, many of us have been victims of this misunderstanding and believed it sincerely and did not understand the teaching here. Anyway, in this case, again, it's a vow. It's something totally separate from the tithing law. That's a different thing. When there is a nation, God sets a nation. You know, and one tribe or one group of people is taken to be serving, you know, in the position of the servants of God, to serve the people and to serve God. You see, that's a different issue here. And the apostles, fully comprehending this, the differences between these two did not mix one with the other. There's many others who did not understand, and they did. They just said, you know, that God said very plainly, Jesus Christ said, you know, the laborer is worthy of his hire. So give him, you know, in other words, if you got one person serving 100, you know, it gives a little measure of it, of what he needs to care for that man. You see, but if you got 100 people, each one gives 10%, well, this man, you know, the minister is going to be a very rich man. You see, when each one gives 10%, that's not what he meant. Well, the ministry is a totally different thing. He gives them their needs. But the tithing law was something totally different. And so when God, again, gathers Israel, brings them back to their land, and the nation is set together, all, you know, with all the sacrifices and temple and things like that, then the tithing law is again in effect. And if you don't understand, you know, how things work in between, obviously, you're going to misapply statements that you read in the Bible for something else. So this is, again, what Jacob did when he came back. He took of all the cattle that he had, and he brought it literally as an offering and as a sacrifice. He's not doing God's work. He's not giving it to the ministry. This is not, you know, for buying TV, you know, time and radio and paying salaries and fleet cars and things like that, you see. This is an occasion where you take the tenth of what you have and you literally offer it to God. Man doesn't get anything out of it. So the two should be separate, and this one should not be used as an example of tithing. You know, or the law of the tithing, that is, they're two separate things. And that's what it makes it very plain. This was a vow. And it's not a vow to obey the law of tithing, it's a vow to do a certain thing, to offer it directly to God. And so we continue here in chapter 29. Then Jacob, in verse 1, then Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the children of the east, that is, back east. And east was land of Babylon, from the south to the north. And obviously, in this case, it was northern part of Babylon. And he looked and beheld, a well in the field, and lo, three flocks of sheep lying there by it. In other words, there were three separate flocks, and they had shepherds over there. And the shepherds, the men generally, were the ones tending the flocks, and the maids or the girls or the daughters had different jobs, you know, carrying water and housework and things like that. They were generally not shepherds. Unless, as you see here in the case of Laban, unless he had no sons, direct sons, then you send the girls to do that. And so this is what you read. There were three flocks of sheep lying there by it, for out of that well they watered the flocks. And the stone upon the well's mouth was great. In other words, it was a big stone that they generally would place on top of the well so strangers would not come and make use of it. And so this is what happened here. And so the stone was very great, and so they were all waiting until more flocks would come, in other words, more shepherds, and altogether they would roll it and take care of the flocks. One of them could not do it on his own, with the exception of one, as we shall see. And there were all the flocks gathered, and they rolled the stone all, you know, when all the flocks came, they all put it together, that is, put their strength together and removed the stone. And so they all rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the sheep and put the stone back upon the well's mouth in its place. Now this is written here because there's something interesting is going to happen here. And when you understand what is happening here, that God is with Jacob, then you understand it's not Jacob and it's not Samson who does it. You see, it's not the strong arm that does it. It's not the horse. It's not the sword. It's God. So God here is involved in the process. And that's why God takes the time here to record all this. That the stone was so great that it took many shepherds to move it and then put it back. One person couldn't do it. But here something else happens. And that's a testimony and a witness that God is giving here to the people. Obviously they saw it and they realized, hey, something special is happening here. A human being cannot do it. And so this is what we read now. And Jacob said unto them, my brethren, who are you, or where do you come from? Now, why are they his brethren? Because, you see, he comes back to the land of Haran. And who was in Haran? The family of Abraham. So everybody there is, they're all one family, one people. You see, so he's addressing them also, not only in the general sense of my brethren, but literally. They were really brethren of the family of Abraham. Brothers, that is, relatives. And they said, of Haran we are. And he said unto them, do you know Laban, the son of Nahor? And they said, we know him. It's one big family. Verse 6, and he said unto them, is it well with him? And they said, it is well. And behold, Rachel, that his daughter, comes with the sheep. Why is she coming with the sheep when the shepherd should be the one doing it? Well, apparently, Laban didn't have sons to take care of that, so he had daughters. And that was also one reason why he was not doing too well financially until Jacob appeared, you know, on the scene. And Jacob is a man, and so he can take care of, well, obviously he had servants that could do it too, but generally people sent their own sons to take care of the flock, and then the servants with them. And Rachel was the boss, in essence, here coming with the flock, and obviously the servants are also there. And so she comes with the sheep, and he said, lo, it is yet high day, neither it is time that the cattle should be gathered together. Water you the sheep. In other words, you know, the sheep are thirsty, you are there, why don't you do it? And in essence, he wants him to move out so he can have, you know, privacy, so to speak, to a point anyway, with Rachel. And so he tells him to do that and go and feed them. And they said, we cannot. You can't roll that stone. That's too big for us. Until all the flocks be gathered together and they roll the stone from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep. You see? So again, God is making a point here. That he's going to do something here that is of God and is not of men. Verse 9, while he was yet speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she tended them. See, she's the one in charge because he had no sons, obviously. And it came to pass, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went near and rolled a stone from the well's mouth. Now the scripture makes it very plain. These people, the shepherds said, all of us put together can do it, but, you know, few of us cannot. By then there were already three flocks, that means, you know, there were a few shepherds there. But even then, they couldn't do it. So here, they're witnessing something very special. And you can imagine that. You can imagine when those people saw it, they told everybody about it, and for years to come, everybody remembered the story of how Jacob moved that stone all by himself. And so God is, in essence, paving the road before Jacob to be recognized as a servant of his. And in the future, obviously, he did help him. And so Jacob did it. In other words, God was the one doing it, really, as he promised, I will be with you, never leave you. And so he gives him an encouragement that he's with him. And Jacob knows that. So that helps develop a relationship there. And also helps others. We're going to recognize that the God of Jacob is God, the true God, you see. To begin with, you know, they know of him because of the family of Abraham, but here they're going to have a witness. So in the faith of Jacob, they too are going to be blessed. So when God is saying there, in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed, he's an example here. You see, whenever you read a thing like that, you know, think, you know, what is really happening here and understand and comprehend, you know, search. And look deeply into the text and you begin to see a whole picture. You know, this is not just a bunch of words. And these are the people that do it, you know, that enjoy reading the Bible and study the law instead of saying, oh, how boring it is. And then this is what Jacob does. He rolls it, obviously with the help of God. And again, verse 10, you know, he rolls the stone and he waters the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. And Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. Now here's Jacob, Rachel, a young woman. We don't know exactly how young, maybe 17, maybe 18, maybe 20. Very young still. And obviously not married. And Jacob, we're talking about a man now in his 70s. He's not a young man. And so he kisses her, and we're not talking about the kisses, you know, that we think about, but, you know, the way you kiss a relative and the way you kiss in the Middle East, you know, both cheeks. And Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept, and Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's brother, and that he was Rebekah's son. He was just overcome with emotions, you know, as he saw her, and reaching a destination, reaching the family of his mother, and, you know, it's emotional too, so he weeps. And you see, in those days, people were not afraid to weep, you know, Jacob is not afraid to weep and cry, and then later on you see here one of his sons, Ephraim, and then others, who get hardened in their heart, and, you know, they have the stiff upper lip, you know, they don't cry, they bite their teeth, and people are teaching their sons, don't cry, you know, boy, you got to be a man. Well, this is not biblical, this is not proper, this is not godly, to develop a heart of stone, you see. And Jacob, you see, here, and then we'll see Joseph later on also, you know, the father of Ephraim and Manasseh. He was not like they became. He was tender-hearted, and he wept, and he cried, and so did all the tribes, that is the chieftains of the tribes, you know, the 12 sons of Jacob. And you see throughout the Bible, And you see, Jesus, you know, he watches Jerusalem and he's overcome with emotions and he wept. A lot of people have forgot to do it. They don't know how to weep. That tells you what happened to our heart. We're not talking about, you know, that false concept of emotions, you know, when people become mushy and some men would say, well, he's a sissy, he cries. We're talking about natural, wholesome, clean, pure emotions. And people have been perverted, unfortunately. We're not natural, is it? You know, we've lost our natural affection. Anyway, this is what we see here. These are examples for us to learn from. And it came to pass, well, anyway, he's telling her that he is her relative. And so she ran to her father and told her father, verse 13, and it came to pass when Laban heard the tidings of Jacob, his sister's son, and imagine, you know, for years they haven't heard from them. You see, Jacob is now, he's in his 70s, so for 70 years, you know, they haven't heard from their sister. And here is a son of hers. In other words, eyewitness, personal eyewitness. So you can imagine how emotional everybody was. And so he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house and told, and he told that Jacob told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, surely you are my bone and my flesh. And he abode with him the space of a month. And Laban said to Jacob, because you are my brother, you see, brother is a general terminology. Doesn't mean that he's his brother. So oftentimes when you hear about somebody being a son of, it doesn't mean literally a son of. It could be a great-great-great-great-son, like, you know, son of David. So you have to understand biblical terminology. Because you are my brother, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be? So at this point, you know, he's decent, honest with him. He doesn't want to take advantage of him. After all, he's a man and he's in his 70s. He's not a child. And he needs to make a living too. And have decent, you know, noble life. And so now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah and the name of the younger was Rachel. And Leah's eyes were weak. And the word in Hebrew is rakot, which means tender. So it's not really weak. It's just tender. In other words, they are not those blazing eyes that some women have, in contrast to other women, where, you know, you just look at the eye and don't see anything special there. That's what it means, tender. They're not the blazing, you know, sparkling eyes. And obviously Rachel was not that way. But Rachel was beautiful, was of beautiful form and fair to look upon. And Jacob loved Rachel. I can't blame him. And he said, I will serve thee 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter. In other words, Jacob has nothing with him. And so the custom is you've got to give a dowry to the bride and also to her father. After all, in those days, your daughters, your sons, you know, your children were your employees. You know, if somebody gets married, you lost an employee. And that's in essence, is a part of the bargain here. Well, you got to pay me for my investment. We today live in a society where we invest so much in our, especially daughters, and then it comes to the wedding and we have to foot the bill for the wedding, for the daughter, and we get nothing for it. And we take it for granted, that's the way it is, but you see, biblically, that's not right. You see, the hire is worthy of his labor. And the parents have labored an awful lot. On their children, spend an awful lot, especially nowadays, and yet they get nothing out of it. Sometimes, you know, unfortunately, they don't even get to see their kids because, you know, they went so far away, and now and then, you know, they may call them on the phone and maybe see them. That's how far away we have departed from God, and we take it for granted, but God regards it as gross iniquity, and He's going to destroy this way of life, this society, the way we know it today. And restore men to the land where all are all, you know, together in the land where they should be. Anyway, in verse 19 we continue. And Laban said, it is better that I give it to you than that I should give her to another man. Abide with me. And Jacob served 7 years for Rachel. And to him it was quite a bargain. And there seemed unto him but a few days for the love he had toward her. In other words, here we have a principle. And God talks about that principle too, when he condemns, in essence, his people. As you read in Revelation, you have forgotten your first love. What is the nature of first love? You see? The nature of first love, that it can be with somebody that you love very much, and there are many aspects to it, and it can be hours and hours or days or whatever, and it looks like just few moments, few seconds. But if you lose that first love, and even 5 minutes, it's too long being with, you know, your mate. You see? And some people, they come before God, and, you know, after a short time, they get a little bit antsy, and they want to go. You know, want to go and do their own thing. They think they've been, you know, they spent too much time with God. You see? And, you know, there are many aspects to it. But this is a part of it. And so this is what is emphasized here, and this is what Christ said later on, emphasizing this aspect. That when you love someone, no matter how much you give, no matter how much time you're with that person, it looks just as if it was only a few moments. Anyway, we should stop here. And this is again Mordecai Joseph saying greetings to all of God's people. Until next time.